Pigeon v. State of Nevada, 67083. Once counsel come forward. Counsel, if you are ready to proceed, please state your name for the record, and additionally, if you wish to reserve any time.
My name is Sandra Stewart. I am appearing on behalf of Mr. Pigeon, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes at the end. We basically have a very similar issue to the previous case. Mr. Pigeon suffers from paranoid schizophrenia with delusions of grandeur. He's a very intelligent man. He received a business degree from Notre Dame University. He received an architectural degree from Drexler College. He was a captain in the Army, honorably discharged, and he was married with 3 children. All of this before the schizophrenia took effect. After that, he became schizophrenic. He lost his job. He lost his home. He lost his wife, he lost his children. And at age 51, he was homeless, jobless. He got around town by jogging and taking the bus. One time when he was at the bus stop, he encountered a 12-year-old girl. And in his mind, which is very delusional, he believed that this girl was in love with him. He concluded that based on facial expressions, body language, light conversation, all of which this girl denied. But to him, this was his reality. His plan was to get to know the girl better, to eventually go to her parents and ask for permission to date her, and eventually ask for permission to marry her. This was a 51-year-old man, and this was his reality as to a 12-year-old young girl. In furtherance of his plan, he on 3 occasions rode the bus, the public bus that the girl was riding to school. On 2 of those occasions, he sat on the lower floor of the bus, and she sat on the top floor of the bus. On 1 occasion, the bus was too crowded for her to go up to the top, and so she sat on the bottom, but they did not sit together. When she got off the bus at her stop for school, he got off the bus as well. She went into a convenience store 3 times, as school kids will do before going to school, and he would follow her in there. He would sit at the video poker machines and watch her, or he would pretend to be looking at chips or whatever and watch her. And at one time he was in the checkout line and he said to her in front of several other people who were there, "You look very nice today." One time outside the convenience store, he put his hand on her arm and said, "I think you're beautiful." She pulled her arm away and walked around him, went on her way. For these acts, Mr. Pigeon was sentenced to 7 life sentences without possibility of parole. Now, there are 2 main issues in this case. One is whether or not he should have been allowed to represent himself, same issue as in the last case. And the other issue was whether police testimony regarding a video which was not preserved by the state should have been admitted. Now, there was a competency hearing before a different judge than the judge that tried the case. From the record, it appeared that the judge who tried the case did not even know that this man was suffering from schizophrenia. She did not know any of the things that occurred in the competency hearing. She did not, or he, I can't remember if it was a he or she who the judge was, but the judge did not obtain a transcript of the competency hearing. At the competency hearing, The defense psychologist testified, and I just want to read this so I don't get it wrong. Pigeon was in love with Candace and wanted to marry her. Pigeon planned to defend himself by informing the jury that Candace was in love with him. Pigeon would have a difficult time not incriminating himself or saying things that would be damaging to his case. Pigeon's delusions would keep him from understanding that what he did was wrong or how to keep from incriminating himself. Pigeon had a fixed delusion which could interfere with Pigeon's ability to aid counsel in his defense. The state psychologist testified that Pigeon was competent to stand trial, but he admitted that he never discussed with Pigeon whether he believed that Candace was in love with him, the history of interactions between Pigeon and Candace, conversations between Pigeon and Candace, Pigeon's plan to ask Candace's parents for permission to marry her, or how Pigeon planned to defend the case. Competency judge found Pigeon competent to stand trial. Like I said, the judge was never made aware of the expert testimony in the competency case, competency hearing, and was never advised that Pigeon was suffering from paranoid schizophrenia. The trial court granted Pigeon's request to represent himself with very little canvas. Basically, the court only asked whether or not he knew the charge, understood the charges against him, whether he knew how to file a motion. Just very basic questions.
And I did the trial court ask the all the questions required under Feretta about to establish his ability to represent himself? Are you saying he didn't go through the entire
I don't think he went through the entire list, but most importantly, he never determined that the man was severely mentally deficient. The trial judge never knew that. And I would refer to the court also to Indiana versus Edwards and the statement by the United States Supreme Court. The constitutional guarantee of a fair trial permits a district court to override a Feretta request for defendants whose mental disorder prevented them from presenting any meaningful defense. Well, Mr. Pigeon's defense was that he was in love with the girl, and he believed that she was in love with him. That was his defense. And I think it's also noteworthy that evidence that his defense was defective is the fact that he was sentenced to 7 life sentences without possibility of parole for simply talking to a 12-year-old girl and touching her lightly on the arm one time. Now, the court asked in the previous case what standard or what test we would suggest, and my suggestion would be where a person is schizophrenic, and they're facing a life sentence or worse, that the court should require the attorneys to agree on an independent psychiatrist to evaluate that person to determine whether or not they are competent to represent themselves without assistance of counsel. That would be the standard that I would recommend.
So essentially an IME, independent medical exam?
Yes.
So, and I assume part of that would be if the attorneys couldn't agree, then the judge would appoint somebody independent to do it then.
And I would say independent of Lakes Crossing.
Okay.
Somebody that would be impartial. I think that the right to a fair trial is so important, and especially where a person is facing a life sentence, that the court, we're lay people. How can we evaluate whether this person can represent themselves or not? I think that the court needs assistance from a professional in order to determine that, when there has been testimony by 2 experts, as occurred in this case, during the competency hearing. Both experts agree that this man suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. So that was not a question. And I think that when that...
And that was not relayed to the district court who tried the case?
No. There's nothing in the record that
indicates that. So as part of your standard, would that then be also that the state has an obligation to ensure that the trial judge knows of this evidence? Because...
Yes. Yes.
I mean, it is fluid. It changes.
It puts the defense attorney in a bad position because this person is asking to represent themselves, and so how can the defense attorney really argue against that? That could be seen as, you know, them just wanting to keep this case because of the monetary factor. I don't know, but I think that whenever there's a competency hearing, surely the judge who's the trial judge is going to know that there was a competency hearing. They can find that out just from looking at the minutes. And I think at a minimum, they should be asking for a transcript of that hearing.
So they're alerted to the potential.
Absolutely. Yes. And the other issue, real quick, is that there was a...
What are states elsewhere that have sort of adopted the Illinois versus Edwards invitation and said, we're going to be a little more rigorous here? What standards are those states using?
I have that. I wasn't able to find any.
Okay. I appreciate your help on this.
Okay. Then the second issue, the second most important issue to me was the admission of police testimony about what he saw on a videotape at the convenience store, where he said that he observed Mr. Pigeon masturbating. And the state got a copy of that video, but they waited several months or just before trial before they looked at it, and then they realized that it was unreadable. It's my position that where the state lost the video, which or didn't preserve it, that it could only present secondary evidence of the lost video if the video did not contain exculpatory evidence. And that is the case of Arizona versus Youngblood, 488 U.S. 51, 1988. And in this case, Mr. Pigeon has always maintained that he was not doing anything lewd or sexual, and that therefore the tape, the video itself, would have been exculpatory. And although he didn't say, I object to this officer's testimony based on the best evidence rule, he did actually say, I want the video here, or else I don't think that this policeman should be able to testify.
I'm sorry,
that.
I didn't hear the rest.
He did say that he felt that the video should be played, and if they didn't have the actual video, that the police officer should not be allowed to testify.
The point that you are raising, even though it has the implication you're putting forth, also has an implication that he was capable of self-representation based upon the question he put forth.
The man is intelligent, as I said, but he does suffer from this delusion. And so he was admitting to the jury left and right that his whole defense was that he loved this girl. He felt that she loved him. If he was acquitted, he would still try to make contact with her, try and contact her parents. This was his reality. So even though he was able to object to this one piece of evidence, overall, he had really no theory of defense or no ability to effectively represent himself.
You have 2 minutes left. I'm going to give you 5 minutes on rebuttal. I'll let you use these other 2 minutes. But are there any other of the charges where you're disputing the sufficiency of the evidence or the legal basis before you sit down that you'd like to?
All of the charges, Your Honor, just about. Lewdness, the indictment charges Pigeon with masturbating while in the presence of Candace. The jury instruction says that lewdness is a sexual act which the actor knows is likely to be observed by the victim. There was absolutely no testimony that the supposed masturbation was done in the presence of Candace or that he had any intent for anybody to see it. His testimony was that he didn't masturbate in the store. Aggravated stalking, NRS 200.575. Aggravated stalking requires that the stalker threaten the victim with the intent of placing the person in reasonable fear of death or substantial bodily harm. There was no testimony or evidence to that effect. Luring a child, a Pigeon never lured Candace anywhere. He never attempted to lure her anywhere. He simply followed her and told her twice that she looked pretty. Attempted first-degree kidnapping. The jury instruction said that the defendant had to have the intent to commit the crime. Defendant performed some act toward its commission. Defendant failed to consummate the intended act. This court held in Burkhart versus State that where all contacts with a minor took place in a public place, the defendant had no means of transporting the minor, and there was no testimony which would have allowed a jury to infer that the defendant intended to do with a child, that no rational juror could have inferred from the evidence that the appellant seized the child with the specific intent to detain him against his will. Mr. Pigeon had no way of transporting Candace. She was a 12-year-old. He didn't even have a bicycle. Can you stop?
Okay. As I said, I'll give you 5 minutes. I'm giving the state an additional 5 minutes for their presentation.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Elizabeth Mercer for the state. This is a unique situation where the case itself, he was arrested in, I believe, May of 2013, and by August of 2014, he was already at trial. He was sent to Lakes Crossing. He was only at Lakes Crossing for approximately 4 months before he was returned and found competent by all three of the doctors. A competency hearing was held a couple months later due to scheduling issues with the defense expert, Dr. Harder. And then within 19 days of the court entering its order that he was found competent, the Feretta canvass was conducted. I think the record bears out that Mr. Pigeon, while he may be schizophrenic, was not suffering from schizophrenic He was not suffering from the symptoms of his schizophrenia. Dr. Harder and Dr. Bradley both conceded as much at the competency hearing. And I disagree with Ms. Stewart's assessment that Mr. Pigeon's entire defense was that he loved this girl and therefore he should be absolved of all the charges. He actually put forth a very coherent defense, a defense that I think most defense attorneys would have put forth. In his opening statement, he conceded his guilt on the less egregious charges and said that the state would not be able to prove his intention with regards to the more serious charges such as aggravated stalking, kidnapping, luring a child, etc. I think that's something that most defense attorneys would have conceded because there's really no way to get around the fact that he had these interactions with Candace. Then throughout the trial, he appropriately cross-examined the witnesses. When John Bryant testified that Pigeon was inside of the gas station with Candace, entirely fixed on her the entire duration that he was in there, he got up and cross-examined Mr. Bryant. Well, I purchased something from you, didn't I? That means that I wasn't fixated on her during the entire duration of the time that I was in there. In addition, with regards to his cross-examination of Officer Givens, the first responding patrol officer, he got him to concede, well, you weren't even really investigating a crime. It was more just a concern. And then in his cross-examination of Candace, he impeached her with the differences between her statement, her initial statement to the police, and then her subsequent taped statement, as well as her subsequent testimony. And when Detective LaFreniere got up and testified, he impeached him about the fact that this video wasn't working properly and that he was the only witness that was testifying to these facts, that no other witness observed it, that really the jury only had his word to rely on. And then in his closing argument, he reiterated what he stated in his opening statement. He said he said, I had no place to keep her. They didn't prove intention. I didn't have any way to transport her. They didn't prove that I had a way to transport her. He said that we never proved that his actions were intended to place her in reasonable fear of death or bodily harm with regards to aggravated stalking. And he noted to the jurors that Candace never even reported the incident, that it was a clerk at the store who reported it, which kind of went to his argument that she was never placed in fear of death or bodily harm. He also said in his closing statement, he reiterated the fact that the only evidence pertaining to the open and gross lewdness was the testimony of Detective LaFreniere. So while I understand that Mr. Pigeon suffered from a serious mental illness, schizophrenia, he was not exhibiting those signs. He never had any outbursts in court. I think that when you read the transcripts of every every one of his appearances, you can tell that he's coherent, that he's lucid, that he understood what was going on, that he had the ability to analyze. In fact, he filed a 25-page motion to dismiss the indictment. And kind of the theme throughout all of it was, the state is overcharging me. In the motion, in the trial, in his closing statement to the jury, he always maintained that the state was overcharging. So he clearly was capable of rationally understanding the charges and able to put on a decent defense. The issue came when he chose to testify. And unfortunately, whether he was represented by counsel or not represented by counsel, that issue would have arisen. Because the right to testify is a decision that only the defendant can make. Sure, he makes it based upon his advice of counsel, but, I mean, I'm sure that you all have reviewed plenty of records where defendants chose to go against that advice and testify on their own behalf. And I think that this is a situation where Mr. Pigeon would have done that. He always wanted to say something. With regards to, I was present during the last argument, and I understand that the court is considering whether or not to impose a standard for the courts when they're dealing with people who have histories of mental illnesses. And I don't think that that's necessarily necessary because of the Supreme Court rule that says a court can deny them the right to represent themselves, and obviously in light of Indiana versus Edwards. I disagree with Ms. Stewart about her assessment of whether or not the judge was aware of his mental illness, because before the Beretta canvas even transpired, the court made comments about the fact that he sees that he just came back from competency court and he was found competent. The court was, he went through a very lengthy Beretta canvas with him. He went over all of the necessary requirements of the Beretta canvas. I think the record bears out that he also had the appropriate Supreme Court rule with him when he canvassed the defendant. In addition to the initial canvas, there was another more incomplete canvas done right before trial because the state filed a notice of intent to seek habitual. I think the record also bears out that the court attempted to persuade him that it wasn't in his best interest to represent himself repeatedly in the initial Beretta canvas and then again before trial. And he even said multiple times, I have no problem continuing this matter. I'll send the jurors home. You're facing some very serious potential penalties here. I think it would be best if you were represented by attorney. And Mr. Pigeon was adamant that he wanted to represent himself. The record also bears out that he's done that two times in the past. So, I mean, I understand the court's concern, especially when you're dealing with the serious penalties in both the previous case and this case, but I think that the court was always very cognizant of those concerns.
The concern, and you touched upon it, the mere fact that trial counsel knew he had been through competency doesn't necessarily tell us whether or not the court had reviewed the findings as the competency, why he was deemed not competent to begin with, or why he was deemed competent thereafter. And that's a little concern since it's been raised as we go into Feretta.
Correct. And I understand. Unfortunately, I don't know what papers become part of the court file because I'm not privy to that. I would imagine that they get left side filed like other things, but I don't know that for certain. I do know that, I was trial counsel, so I was present at many of the same appearances that Mr. Pigeon was present at, and he never exhibited any signs that he was incapable of representing himself.
You probably can't testify like that. It needs to be.
I
don't mean to rebuke you in any way. I'm just trying to understand that. It seems to me if he had been denied the right to represent himself, he would be here complaining
Correct.
About that.
Of course.
And we are now here complaining that he should not have been afforded the opportunity to represent himself. And I'm trying to grapple with standards. So that's probably the most helpful. But it does seem to me, and I'm not sure it's not a rule problem. I'm not sure it's not is 253 adequate, and should this be addressed by rule? But we're trying to understand how you would articulate such a rule if you were to adopt one, whether by rule or decision.
So. And I'm not sure that you really could, because I think that the courts are aware that they have this continuing obligation to continue to evaluate a defendant. I mean,
and 253 says that, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And so does prior case law that's been handed down by this court. It says that anytime a district court becomes concerned about the defendant's ability to represent himself or his competency, then that it's incumbent upon them to take measures to protect that right. But as the court pointed out, I think because of the rule of law that says that the denial of a defendant's right to represent himself results in an automatic reversal, I think that courts are hesitant to deny that right unless there's...
It's a structural error. I mean,
right. And I think that because of that, courts are concerned about denying a defendant their right to represent themselves. And I think that they would do it in a situation where it was clear that he couldn't represent himself. But I don't think that that's the case here. I think that he behaved himself during the course of the trial, which is borne out by the record. He behaved himself at all of his court appearances, which is borne out by the record. He asked appropriate questions. He evaluated the law appropriately. He responded to the court appropriately. He was, of course, firm, because I think that's just Mr. Pigeon's personality, which I think you can read from the record as well. But he was always respectful. So I don't think that Mr. Pigeon, I don't think there's any indication in the record that the district court was remiss in revisiting that issue.
Well, what about, you say that he made sensible arguments about overcharging. Could you talk to me a bit about the evidence and the charges that he was convicted of? Your opponent went through at the end of her argument.
Sure.
Some of those charges where she believes the evidence was insufficient to support the conviction.
With regards to his arguments, it was pretty much just that this, with regards to the more serious charges, that the state failed to prove intention. But I think that the evidence in the record is sufficient to sustain those charges. With regards to the open and gross lewdness, the detective testified that he, and I want to correct that issue as well. It was not several months before this error was discovered. If you'll recall, the...
Talking about the videotaped,
yes,
CD error?
By the time the matter proceeded to grand jury, it had already been... that error had already been discovered, and Detective Lafreniere testified to it at the grand jury proceeding, which is part of the appellant's appendix. But...
Was there ever anything offered in the record that this had been properly downloaded in the beginning? I mean, I know it's... There's no accusation that it was intentionally done by the state, but again, the court takes in consideration when a tape or something is not preserved what standard they should impose for the lack,
correct,
of the preservation.
Correct. And I don't think that that issue was thoroughly fleshed out by A, either Mr. Pigeon or B, Ms. Stewart in her appellate brief. I think the issue would have become one of whether the state failed to properly preserve that. But I do believe that the grand jury testimony as well as the trial testimony supports that he sent out an employee of Metro whose task is simply to retrieve the surveillance video. That's what they're hired to do. That he downloaded it, that it appeared to go properly, and then it just wouldn't play, unfortunately.
And that's the sole evidence of the video, is the source of the testimony that he was masturbating in,
correct,
the store. And that's the basis for the lewdness charge, correct?
Correct? Yes.
So if there's a problem with that video, then that lewdness charge drops out, correct?
Well, I mean...
In other words, if that evidence should have been preserved and it was directly destroyed, say.
You mean if there had been some wrongdoing on the part of the state?
Yeah.
I think he might have been entitled to an instruction, a juror instruction, but I don't know.
Is there any other evidence of...
Well, no.
Goodness.
No, because Detective Lafreniere is the only one. He went there and viewed
it. But the store clerk didn't see the guy doing whatever it was.
He testified that he saw him back behind the gaming machines, but he couldn't
but
see what he was doing.
His hands in his...
Well, he did testify that he saw his hands in his pockets when he entered the store.
Okay.
But
the evidence of masturbation,
correct,
was the defendant's viewing of the original video that was not preserved.
The detectives, yes, Your Honor.
I mean, the detectives, I'm sorry. Yeah.
With regards to the aggravated stalking, you have a situation here where on Thursday the victim told Mr. Pigeon, leave me alone, and then he still proceeded to go to the downtown transit station, wait for her Friday, follow her to school. And then he waited for her after school. When the bell rings and people start walking out, he goes inside of the school grounds and gets stopped by a school employee. So I think that the jurors were, I think that they were correct in drawing the inference that the defendant intended to place her in reasonable apprehension of immediate bodily harm or death, because he did not just leave her alone after she told him on Thursday, leave me alone, and ran into the gas station so that he would hopefully just leave her alone. With regards to the luring a child, I think that's the most straightforward in this case, because all it requires is that he knowingly contact her with the intent to persuade, lure, or transport her to another location without permission of her guardian and with the intent to engage in sexual conduct.
What about the burglary charge?
That charge encompassed his conduct for all 3 days, and it alleged with the intent to commit battery, kidnapping, or luring of the child. And I think that the jurors were correct in finding him guilty on that charge because of the conduct that occurred over those 3 days.
But it seemed that there was a conflation of the conduct the first day and the last day with the middle day, seeing that that was the only active day in the store.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't hear the last part of your...
I'm concerned that they conflated testimony as to the one day with the first day and the last day in the store, because there was no representation as to any, say, interaction.
There was testimony that there was interaction to the extent that he followed her into the store on the first day, and then on the second day there was testimony that just prior to entering the store he had grabbed her arm and then continued to follow her into the store.
That's the second.
And then on the last day he followed her in the store again, and when you couple that with his testimony that he loved her and he wanted to be with her and that he wanted to have sex with her, as well as his statement to Detective Lafreniere along those same lines, then I think it becomes clear that he entered the store with the intent of trying to persuade her to go with him and be engaged in a sexual relationship with him.
What was the evidence for attempted first-degree kidnapping?
There was testimony that on the second day he tried to block her from getting to the convenience store or the school, I believe. Sorry, I misspoke.
And this is Hyde Park, so it was the convenience store over on Charleston?
I think they were in the parking lot in front of Sonio's, which is just east of Henson. And I think the testimony was that she was going up or down the stairs, I don't recall which one, and he blocked her path, and that's when the attempted grabbing occurred, and she told him, leave me alone, and ran into the store.
And that's your basis for attempted first-degree kidnapping?
No, Your Honor, it was the course of conduct leading into Friday, where he had never before waited for her after school. And on Friday, he knows that summer is approaching. In fact, his testimony, or his statement bears that out, and his testimony bears that out, that he always followed her to school, but never waited for her after school.
He was sitting at a picnic table or some type of table?
Directly across from the school, fixated on the school and rocking back and forth. And when that bell rang, he got up from the table and entered the school. And his statement to Detective Lafreniere, as well as his testimony at trial, he admitted that he went in there so that he would come into contact with Candace. So I think that when you couple that with the fact that he knew that school was about to get out and he needed to ramp up his efforts to develop a relationship with this girl, there's certainly enough evidence present that the jurors were correct in inferring that he attempted first-degree kidnapping. Because with regards to this first-degree kidnapping, all that was required is that the jury find that he attempted to entice, lure, whatever, with the intent to commit an improper act against a minor, which would have been to engage in sexual conduct. Because he did not have consent to marry her, it would have been improper conduct for him to engage in a sexual relationship with Candace. So I believe that there was sufficient evidence in the record to support that charge, especially when you look at his conduct over the course of the 3 days and the escalation of that conduct into Friday, which was approximately 2 weeks before school got out. Were there any other charges that the court was concerned about? And I also wanted to point out that the Burkhart decision cited by Ms. Stewart is completely distinguishable from the instant case, because in that case, he was not convicted of an attempt kidnapping. It was a second-degree kidnapping. And the issue being examined by the court there was whether the momentary seizure of the child's jacket was sufficient seizure for them to seize, or sufficient evidence of seizure for the jurors to properly have convicted him of that count. And in addition, in that case, he was in the presence of his parents during all three of the brief contacts, and they all occurred on a casino. In the present case, she was alone by herself on her way to school. I'm sure there was traffic going up and down the street, but that's different. It's not like she had an adult there to protect her. It was her and the defendant. In addition, this is an attempt and not a second-degree kidnapping. We're not alleging that there was some sort of a seizure or detention sufficient to sustain an actual charge of kidnapping, just the attempt at kidnapping.
How was he going to transport her?
Well,
or,
I don't...
Or restrain her?
I don't think that... Of course, indulgence, Your Honor. I don't... The statute requires that he leads, takes, entices, or carries away, so I don't think that it was necessarily incumbent upon the state to prove that he had a means to transport her, that he had a car waiting nearby, or anything of that nature. Furthermore, we know that these two rode the public transit system, so he very easily could have transported her on the public transit system in order to get her away and commit the acts of sexual conduct.
Thank you. Ms. Stewart, the court has extended you 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I disagree with the state about the defendant, about Mr. Pigeon's conduct throughout the trial. The judge was often chastising him, seemed angry with him, mentioned to him, you think that you're the smartest man in the room, but you're not, that type of thing. I even noticed that interaction between Mr. Pigeon and the court, that animosity when I appeared, when I went to court to confirm as appellate counsel. I believe that the trial court equated the competency court's finding that Mr. Pigeon was competent to stand trial as competency to represent himself. I think that the court conflated those two.
Did the court do a Feretta canvas?
Beg your pardon?
Did the court do a full Feretta canvas?
I don't believe that it did. I mean, I think that a full Feretta canvas, when a person has been to a competency court, requires the court to look at what happened during that competency hearing. That's my opinion.
Any language law from other jurisdictions as of that point?
No. I obtained a complete copy of the court file, a complete copy of all transcripts, a complete copy of all exhibits, and all of that was included in the appendix. So from that, we can tell that the trial court did not know that Mr. Pigeon was schizophrenic, did not have a copy of the record from the competency hearing. None of the attorneys told the court that Mr. Pigeon was suffering from this horrible mental illness. As to the video, it's the appellant's position that was negligently preserved by the state. Once they copied it or downloaded it or whatever, they should have made sure that it played correctly. Not only that, but when the detective looked at the video, there was a store employee with him that looked at the video. The state never called that store employee to testify or to corroborate what the detective was saying that he saw on that video. So that was concerning to me. As to the burglary charge,
let me go back. That is one of the difficulties when someone chooses to represent themselves. They have ability to call witnesses also. And that's one of the problems when we have individuals attempting to represent themselves in court on their own behalf who are not skilled in the process.
Correct, Your Honor. I agree. As to the burglary, the three felonies that supposedly Mr. Pigeon had the intent to commit at the moment that he entered the convenience store were battery, kidnapping, and luring a child. There were other people in the convenience store. It just brains logic to think that he went in there with the intent of pulling her out of that store and taking her away or luring her away, when everybody in the store, it's a small store, could hear what he was saying. He didn't go in there with the intent to commit a battery. He didn't commit a battery. He didn't even touch her. Even when they were outside of the store on the second day, he got in front of her and just touched her arm. He didn't grab her. He touched her arm and said, "I think that you're beautiful." She immediately pulled her arm away, walked around him. He did not in any way impede her progress or stop her or grab her or anything like that. And I don't have anything further unless you have any.
Could you talk to me about attempted first-degree kidnapping and your view of the sufficiency of the evidence on that?
Well, an attempt crime is a specific intent crime. So the state has to show that he had the specific intent to kidnap her in order to convict on attempt. He walked into the school, but he testified that he was going there not only to see Candace, but also to get a drink of water. Now, he fully admitted that he wanted to get to know Candace, that he wanted to meet her parents, that he wanted to ask them for permission to date her. So I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that he went in there to talk to her, to get to know her, but not there's no evidence that he had an intent to drag her out of the school with no way to transport her in full view of all her schoolmates.
That will conclude our argument for this day. The court thanks counsel for Mr. Pigeon as well as the state for the arguments put forth today. The Indiana versus Edwards, the right to self-represent as well as competency, is a very difficult issue to consider. We will look at this matter. This matter now stands submitted.